Welcome to Days in the Wild. I just want to talk to you real quick before we jump into this next episode. I can't urge you enough to get out there and give us a review on iTunes or the Podbean app. It's super important. Helps me keep this free, helps me reach new people and continue to grow. If you don't know how to do that, hit me up and I'll help you through it. Also want you to go and give Phoenix Shooting Bags a look. Check out their website, phoenixshootingbags.com. They are our main sponsor and they put an excellent product out, and it means a lot for me for you to go check them out and take a look and see what they got. So without further ado, let's roll into this next episode. Hi, welcome to Days in the Wild, Big Game Hunting Podcast. We are continuing on with our What Would You Do series, talking elk, throwing some different scenarios out there, and listening to guys who just get it done year in, year out, and how they approach these scenarios, and how, if you listen to the different nuances of how guys look at the situation and how they approach it and add these things in into your repertoire and, you know, build yourself into a better elk hunter. Today I have a buddy of mine, Steve Chappell, on, and Steve is a guide here in Arizona, and consequently one of the guys actually taught me how to cow call and bugle back in the day. So what's going on, man?
Oh, just hanging out, looking forward to September, you know, getting through this crazy time, and definitely look forward to it more than ever right now. It can't get here soon enough. I'm doing a lot of editing these days, John, getting season 3 of Elk Camp ready for Sportsman Channel. So staying busy for sure. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. Real quick before I got a couple other questions for you, but why don't you give us a little rundown about yourself other than what I've told people, because I don't think I've ever had you on the show before.
Yeah, thanks, John. So I grew up in a hunting family, really blessed and fortunate that way. My dad introduced me to hunting at a really young age, I'd say 5 or 6. And then I became a guide back in the early 90s, and that's basically because dad had started guiding. So I kind of got my feet wet there starting out with him. And then, you know, there in the late 90s, you know, after I'd been married a few years and started a family and all that, I started Chappell Guide Service there in Arizona, like in 98, I believe it was. Mm-hmm. Always have loved the video aspect of it. I would say I got into the video aspect there in the early 90s, and it just progressed from there. For me, it's not so much just about putting a tag on an elk, but getting that process of the hunt and the excitement and, you know, the reality of an old over-the-shoulder hunt on video. That's what really makes me tick. You know, I had an Extreme Bulls DVD series. Yep. That ran for 8 videos. Have also been real fortunate to get to do a couple of elk videos on the San Carlos Apache Reservation there in Arizona. That was a lot of fun being there with those giant bulls. But then I saw, you know, as we got into this digital age that we're in now, that the DVD business was just really going to die out, and it did. So I had to decide whether I was going to continue or just stop it. And I decided to go ahead and jump off, so to speak, with both feet, and started airing this show Elk Camp on the Sportsman Channel in 2018. And time has kind of flown. We're entering into our 3rd season here. It's going to start again June 29th, 7:30 p.m. Eastern time on Mondays. So I'm really excited about that. Since it's in season 3, I'm finally able to start airing some of the first season episodes on YouTube. So I've kind of been loading those and airing those on YouTube for any of your listeners that want to catch any of those season 1 episodes. But yeah, it's just been, you know, a 20 plus year journey to get here, and it's been great all along the way. You know, always challenges in everything someone does, but I will say I wouldn't change anything and absolutely love what I'm doing.
Awesome. Yeah. I used to love watching those, Extreme Bulls DVDs, man. Because at the time, like, you know, you and like the Primos guys a little bit, but like, it was the first like real in your face, you know, up close and personal
elk hunting. Of course, you know, being mostly Arizona stuff, it was big bulls and, you know, it was fun to watch. Yeah. I used to enjoy
There's no better place. Right, John? There's no better place to film elk than in Arizona. I couldn't agree with you more. Elk are the biggest movie stars, too. I just think they're natural-born movie stars with how majestic they are. And then you add the calling element and that interaction with them with the calls. And I've always wanted to make my videos exciting and encounter focused, to where it's the mainstay of the video is about the encounters and the excitement of that. And I feel like I've really, continued that into the TV show. It's got the same feel as those Extreme Bulls videos with just some more higher end production elements that we have these days.
Awesome. Yeah, I checked out a few episodes on TV. And no, I liked it, man. It brought me back to those days of watching your original stuff. You know, of course, with a much better camera and video. Yes. At this point, but
yeah, absolutely, yep.
It's crazy how far along that stuff's come, huh?
Yeah, it is.
So
yeah, I remember back in the day, you know, basically to be big time with video, you had to spend thousands on a video camera. You know, I know the big thing back in the 90s was the Betacams. And now someone can get into videoing with 4K or 1080p for, you know, really less than that. There's some good cameras for less than $1,000, really. You know, I'm running. Yeah.
You could do it on your iPhone, you know.
A lot of it. I do see a lot of footage airing on off of phones. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've actually done complete episodes, and this was before the iPhone got to 4K and as good as it was. I actually, one of my elk hunts, it's called the iPhone Bull, that I have on YouTube, is my camera took a shit. It just stopped working. I think the batteries were shorted or something. And
yeah,
we ended up having to film pretty much the whole hunt on my iPhone, and it ended up turning out pretty good, you know? But,
Yeah, that's pretty sweet to have as a backup, man. 4K video as a backup, right?
Right. Yep. Exactly. So, but cool, man. Well, so with this series that we're doing, I'm basically throwing out a lot of similar, if not the exact same scenarios, at different guys from different parts of the country with different elk hunting tactics, with different experiences, and kind of throwing the same situations at them to see what they would do in those situations. Okay. So I'm going to throw a couple at you and see how you would handle them.
Sounds good. We'll see if I come out of right field or where I'm at, right?
Yeah, exactly. So this is very Arizona. This is like one of my, this was born out of Arizona, this situation. It's hot. It's, you know, that early archery hunt, maybe that first week. The moon is full. You're not really hearing bugles during the day, but you hear them at nighttime. So you know there's elk going in, you know, in the area that you're hunting. What are you doing?
Yeah, John, that's a great first question. That's exactly the scenario that was the start of the archery season last year in 2019. Mm-hmm. I remember the bugling was super slow. Me and my hunter Tim from Ohio, the first three mornings of the hunt were almost a carbon copy of each other. We would go out, nothing would be bugling, or maybe they'd be bugling a little bit in the dark, but the minute gray light hit, it would be that famous Arizona gray light shutdown, I call it, where they just stop bugling, go away from you, and you have no idea really what your next move's gonna be. So each of those three mornings, we ultimately had super close encounters with herd bulls. First off, I think it's because we didn't give up and we didn't get dejected. These encounters happen a good hour and a half to 2 hours after light.
Okay.
And I believe what it was getting close enough to these bulls, you know, kind of unknowingly. I'd say a little bit of luck was involved in it, sure. But, you know, being out there early in the dark and hearing them bugle to know that they were in the vicinity was the start of it. But basically what I would do is I would blow an aggressive lip ball bugle or a chuckle at them. And herd bulls, what we have to understand about them is they're all about jealously guarding their cows. They are very jealous and defensive of that herd of cows that they have. So those bulls inevitably would give away their location to that bugle. Again, either a lip ball bugle or either an aggressive chuckle from a distance. And then they would get quiet again. So what we would have to do is really pay attention to that bugle. One bugle we would get, make our way to them, cut the distance down as much as we could. And what happened in all three of those situations, I either saw cows first or I would get a visual on the bull. So okay. I would know that I was dealing with a herd bull. And dealing with a herd bull, I found that they are more vulnerable than I used to think, and that you and your viewers may think they're or your listeners, they're more vulnerable than we think. And again, it's because of that jealousy over their cows. Mm-hmm. So my goal in each one of those three encounters, those first three mornings, was to get inside for sure of 120 yards, hopefully more like 75 to 100 yards, which we did. And when we got in that position, I would blow a lip ball bugle. Some people call it a display bugle. Mm-hmm. A guy named Joel Turner calls it a bull calling cows bugle. Typically what I do, John, is I started off with a high sweet note. So I go into a high pretty note as if I'm just going to do just a straight high pitched bugle. And then after about a second, I dump it down into that lip ball sound. And I'm telling you, those herd bulls, when you do it, when you do that sound, and it's key, you got to do it with the right volume, the right tone, and with that comes the right emotion. When you put all of that together and you blow that call aggressively at him, and I say you don't want to blow it as if you're asking a question, you're making a statement at that bull. You're being aggressive, and it kind of flies in the face of how I usually call and my personality. I'm not really that guy that goes out and throws the dukes and is looking to fight. But when I get in there with a bull, I can kind of switch. I can turn my personality to that. And I'm telling you, John, when you get in that zone with him and he feels like you're a real threat, it puts him in that fight or flight mode. And I believe when you blow that call correctly, 9 times out of 10, he's going to come over aggressively with purpose. And that's what happened. So again, when it's early season, I by no means, you know, I say I don't bat 1,000. I by no means do that. Mm-hmm. But those first three mornings of that poor hunt in Arizona last year, because of the earliness, the heat, the moon phase, and it being slow, we were able to have 3 shots at herd bulls on those first three mornings by using those tactics.
Nice. And so I want to talk a little bit about that specific to Arizona as far as the conditions that you faced. Typically, full moon, how are you seeing that the elk are reacting to a full moon?
Yeah, John, I see over and over that elk in Arizona, and I'm sure elsewhere, will really utilize that nighttime light. I feel like it's just instinctual that they take advantage of that, because just like us, you go out in a full moon, you can see really well.
Right.
And it's the same way for them. So they carry on all night. They feed, they water, they fight, they rut, they bugle and carry on. And by the time light cracks in the morning, they're tired and wore out. So they're ready to just shut up and go lay down in bed. So really, with that in mind, you really obviously have to take advantage of that, you know, early prime time. And then if you're not close to them at that time, like I was saying earlier with those three encounters, you got to get close to them, because bugling at them or calling at them, cow calling at them from 400 or 500 yards away may not even get a response a lot of times versus being in super tight with them. But it's really common in Arizona. I feel like the archery hunt most years, if it's starting around the 10th to the 14th, that's still kind of pre-rut time. And yes, you can have some days where there's good bugling, but more often than not, that first few days of the hunt can be very slow. And I also tell people and tell my hunter, you know, we don't want to get burned out both physically and emotionally. If the elk aren't cooperating, we just do the best we can, but we don't want to burn ourselves out and not be, you know, on our A game, so to speak, when things get better.
Right. Let me ask you this. What dates do you think are typically our best rut dates here in AZ?
You know, if I could pick any 2-week period, I would probably want to start around the 20th and go into early October, say the first 3 days of October. But I would say the very best would probably be from, say, the 24th or 25th to the 1st of October most years. That's going to be when the best rutting happens. A lot of times that coincides with the early rifle or muzzleloader hunt. Mm-hmm. And again, I always say the best week of the archery hunt, if someone has to choose, you know, you can kill a bull at any point during the archery hunt, depending on your tactics. But if I had to choose and was forced, I would pick the second week of the archery hunt. Usually going to be, you know, the 18th, 17th, 18th to the 24th or 25th of September, something like that.
Nice. Nice.
Yep.
This is a selfish question. So what are some of the things that you're doing to find areas to hunt? Like preseason, before you get boots on the ground scouting, what are you looking for? I mean, you know all these units very well now, and I'm sure you got your spots, but let's say you were hunting in a unit you'd never hunted before. What would you be doing to find out where, or what would you do to find where you want to start your efforts?
Yeah. The first thing I would want to do is think about what elk need. Elk need water. They have to have water. They have to have good feed. They have to have good shade and cover. And then, you know, it doesn't hurt for it to be isolated and more secluded. So I'm looking for that to start with. Then, contrary to how, you know, you might think, like during the summertime, if I were able to get out there, I would want to find groups of cows and calves. That's what I would be looking for, because even though bulls, many times in these units, well, most times the bulls are going to be separate from the cows, especially the more mature bulls, and they could be way away from the cows. And it seems like a lot of times they're more in the desolate, more dry parts of these units and more isolated. And then during the rut, they're going to go find and join up with those cow calf groups as opposed to the cows going to them. So, you know, mainly I'm looking for, you know, again, those three things, the feed, water, the cow calf groups, bedding areas. Also, I'm looking for areas that have signs of rutting activity, like last year's rubs. If I see that, I know that's going to be a consistent rutting area where I'm going to want to look at and focus on potentially. You know, if I weren't able to put boots on the ground at all, you know, I would want to do, you know, a lot of looking at maps. You know, I know in Arizona, I really like the Flatline maps. I really like their app, the Flatline maps, and also Onyx, where you can look at and identify the water sources. And then the first thing I would do when I got to the unit is I would start going around and checking those water sources, number one, to see if they have water, because our water, especially in ponds, can be very hit and miss. Mm-hmm. Based on monsoonal activity. And then, of course, checking for elk sign around those water sources, because it's definitely key in Arizona.
For sure. Awesome. Yeah, it's a lot of what I like to do. And I like to ask that of guys, especially guys that hunt where I hunt, and just see if my methodology is in line with other successful guys, you know?
Yeah, so absolutely.
It's good to, you know, get a little reassurance once in a while that the things that you do, other than with your own successes, you know. But anyway,
the hardest part in the whole scenario, John, is getting a tag. I think you would agree.
Yeah, for sure.
That's why a guide.
Yeah, so you could go elk hunting every year.
Exactly.
Right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. You know what? I honestly stopped like putting in for those just high upper tier units years ago. And I haven't pulled that many tags here. I've done two late season archery elk and been successful on both of them.
Wow.
And, wow. I've only had two, you know, early archery tags myself. And, as a matter of fact, one of them, I shot a bull, but I never recovered it. And the other one, I shot my biggest Arizona bull, but
nice.
Yeah. So I haven't had a bunch of tags here. So now I don't put in for those high end hunts anymore. It's because I know I'm not going to draw them, you know?
Gotcha.
Yeah. I get that.
Yes. And some of those units that it used to be like really, really, really good that we're chasing after. Like, I remember, didn't you shoot like a giant, like 400 inch bull or something like that in unit 7 years ago that you couldn't recover?
It was a 350 type bull.
Oh, 350.
He's here in my office. He's a beautiful bull, no doubt. He's now 400, but he's still a solid bull. And yeah, that's a long story. I won't go into all the details, but thankful for a incredible sportsman named Charlie Rust, who, you know, we're still friends to this day. He found my bull 2 weeks after my hunt. And ultimately, we were able to reunite with that bull. I had to go through all the legal channels to do that with Game and Fish and everything, and did everything right, thankfully. But yeah, it was I guess kind of a bad situation that ended well, thanks to a great sportsman. And so, it's a wonderful thing to sit here and look at this bull and be thankful about that.
Yeah, I remember that scenario. Well, anyway, the reason why I brought that up is because like now that unit sucks. Yeah, Fish and Game
it is
murdered that unit.
Yeah, it's a tough one.
Anyway, all right. So here my next scenario for you is you got a bull located up on a ridge, and he seems to be like he's there and he's in place. He's been bugling from the same spot, hasn't shown any like defensive sounds, just seems to be like locating, and he seems like he's not going to be going anywhere because he's been in that same spot on the same side of the ridge for a while. What are you doing? You know, the what, why, how, and when, what are you doing to get this tag on this bull?
Yeah. So it sounds like this bull is probably not a herd bull because you said he's not making defensive sounds. I was going to jump to the conclusion that he was a herd bull, so he was standing his ground, but it sounds like maybe he's not. If he was, I would cut the distance down. Definitely, that would be my first line of attack. And also the fact that he's not moving and not budging tells me, if he's a satellite bull, that he's not really worked up and he's not really in the mood to deal with you, you know, to come to a long distance call for sure. I found so many times over and over that distance is the determiner and is what makes all the difference in the effectiveness of my calling. So in that scenario, I feel like what I would do is I would stop calling at him, and I would pick up and I would try to move and get into his zone. Obviously, with the wind in mind would be my first thing I would want to do. I always like to deal with the wind, John, in a way that when I get in there and I get within, say, 120 yards of where I think this bull's at, that when I call to him, that he can't easily go downwind and get my wind right away. If you give the bull the opportunity to do that, most of them, 9 times out of 10, will do that right away. Mm-hmm. They'll get you your wind, and then it's over with, because wind is everything with elk hunting. So again, I would really try to get that wind heavily in my advantage. I've been really fortunate over the years to be real good with depth perception and knowing about right where that bugle came from, the last one I heard. So I would move in there super tight. All the hunters who hunt with me always say that's one thing they say when they talk about hunting with me, is that when I first started hunting with Steve, he gets way closer than what I expected and what I've experienced in the past before he blows a call. And with that said, what I feel is really important when you get close like that is to be able to really control your calls. And that starts with controlling your emotion. Because as you can imagine, John, when you've hiked up that ridge to get close to him, plus you're dealing with the emotions of knowing that there's a bull there that you may potentially get a shot at, emotions can get really overwhelming. And for me, it's been that way for 30 years. So I really have to kind of talk to myself and coach myself along the way. And a lot of times even put myself in that position where I think, okay, you're just in your truck or you're just outside in your yard and you're just practicing your calls. It's no different. You know, I try to put myself in that mental state of mind, and I try to take deep breaths and slow my breathing down to where I get my breathing deep, coming from deep down in my stomach. And that allows me to make better sounding calls, and then also to control those calls. So if I moved in really close to that bull in this scenario, the first thing I would probably do with that bull, assuming I think he's a satellite bull, is to just blow a nice, sweet, soft cow call to him. It's how I would introduce myself. And then I would wait for him to react. Sometimes you have to blow two or three calls to get them to react and to come over. And then if they do, I go ahead and just, you know, juice them with what they want to hear. If he answers that cow call every time he bugles, I'm just going to give him just a little bit of time to bugle, cock his ears at me. Then I'm going to give him another cow call or two. And I'm just going to coax him that way. If he doesn't respond, I'm going to go into what I call silent calling. In other words, I'm doing some calling, but he's not calling back to me. So in that instance, I have to assume that maybe he's coming in silently. And I've been caught, I'll say I've been caught as recently as last year, big old bull bugled in the distance. We did exactly what I'm talking about. We moved in and cut the distance. I cow called a little bit. He never answered. So I started moving forward, John. And me and my hunter and cameraman were moving forward. And this 360 bull walks out into this opening right in front of us. He's coming right at us. And we're caught with our pants down. Wow. And of course, he gets away. So, you know, patience is a virtue in calling. I could probably do a little better with that in that area. I just like bulls that respond and bulls that want to play the game. I do better with, for sure.
Yeah, me too. I am definitely not. I'm definitely not good at playing the slow game.
Yeah, me too. That's not my forte.
You know, it's funny because when I first started elk hunting, I was super cautious about everything, like very patient, took my time with everything, and because I treated them like deer. And then I went with some guys that were super aggressive, and I saw the success that they had, and then I just became aggressive. Now it's just like I can't go back. But it's definitely to your benefit to be able to read the situation, and be what you need to be, you know?
Oh, totally.
Don't be one-sided.
Absolutely, John. I think that's why I'm a better elk hunter than a deer hunter. I mean, I love elk. They're my first love for sure. And there's really no second, to be honest with you. Mule deer is a distant second. But yeah, I really like to make things happen. I like the calling game. So when you put me in a scenario where it's just totally about patience or spot and stock, and that's just not my thing.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. No, I get I mean, don't get me wrong. I love spot and stalk deer, but when an elk, and you know, I shouldn't even say that because I got those two late archery bulls. I mean, I hunted them just like big deer, but yeah, it's still, I feel like I find myself being more aggressive. Like I move more, I'm less worried about being quiet, all that stuff. So
yeah, with elk, you're right.
Yeah. So I know from our past conversations what you're going to say for this, but I'm going to ask it for you anyway. It's midday. You haven't been on bulls all morning long. What are you doing? Are you doing anything? Change it up, or are you even worried about the midday stuff?
I typically don't push elk during the midday in Arizona, by and large. I've just found that most times I do more damage than good during that time. Arizona has a real marked shutdown in the mornings, and then they typically don't pick back up till, you know, fairly late in the evenings. You're lucky if it's, you know, late afternoon before they pick up and bugle again. There's been times, you know, if there's cloudiness or it's a little drizzly or whatnot and the rut's going good, that they can keep bugling. Mm-hmm. And I'm all about staying on them as long as they're bugling. But when they really shut down, I'm just really hesitant to go and blow a herd of elk out of an area and then basically be starting over with them or having to go, you know, completely start over and hunt other elk. So mainly I don't mess with them during the midday. I have had occasional success when there's a full moon, back to the full moon scenario, that there will be a period during the midday when they can be a little bit active. But again, it can be really risky with being in there near their bedding areas. The guy's got to be really particular about the wind. So by and large, John, like you know, and like we've talked about, I mainly hunt them when they're active and vocal, and that's mostly mornings and evenings in Arizona predominantly.
Gotcha. Do you, you know, obviously being a guide, you want to try to provide as much opportunity as possible for your clients. Do you ever utilize, you know, putting the clients on water holes or anything during the middle of the day? Do you find that there's any, you know, those water holes that are close to bedding that you might get a bull that might walk up, get up and go have a drink midday or something like that?
Yeah, exactly. It depends on the unit. You're exactly right. The water sources and their proximity to the bedding. You're totally right about that. So you got to be wise about the water sources that you would pick to do that. And then for me, it depends on the hunter. You know, is he a guy that, you know, is a hard charger and, you know, wants to be out there all day? Or is he a guy that, you know, might need a little bit of rest and recuperation? Because the hunt, you know, you go 10, 14 days, it can really start grinding on you after a few days. You know, getting up at 3 a.m. and going to bed at 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, it can start wearing on you. So I kind of play that by ear, just depending on my hunter.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
But you do feel like that's a good tactic. Like, you know, if a guy was, you know, gung ho, you think sitting on water hole midday is not fruitless.
It can be. Yeah. Again, you have to be real wise about picking a water source and making sure that, you know, an elk doesn't have to move 2 miles to get to it. You know, if an elk can move a half a mile, quarter of a mile, absolutely.
Good advice. Well, Steve, I want to, you know, thank you for sharing your information with us. That's all I got for you on this one. We'll have you back on and we will, we'll throw some other scenarios at you and see what you would do with those. But, for now, I want to thank you for coming on and taking the time.
Yeah. Thank you, John. It's been a lot of fun and, hope you're doing great and your listeners as well. And, I'll look forward to talking about some more scenarios. It seems like, every elk and every situation is different. So the possibilities are kind of endless out there. So we all learn every year.
Absolutely.